You might wonder about the title, Peter and Jesus in the Olive Press. The word Gethsemane means olive press. And so we're familiar with Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account of Jesus in Gethsemane and his prayers. As I've explained about those prayers, Jesus was not trying to escape the cross. We learn that from Matthew 26:42. If we pay close attention to that verse, Jesus said, "If this cup cannot pass unless I drink it." The cup is a reference to his sufferings. He was suffering there in anticipation of the cross. But the drinking of the cup is a picture of him dying on the cross. So Jesus was praying that the cup would pass from him, but he's not praying that he would escape the cross. He was praying that he might be able to face that quickly rather than having to wait for it to occur. Okay, so we can understand that Jesus had a test there. But then we have Peter. And Peter has said that he will die for Christ. He will lay down his mortal life for Jesus. He said that back in John 13:37. He pulls out a sword, but he did not lose his life as he expected to. He did not kill the high priest's slave. Things did not go in the way that Peter had thought that they would go. But then we have the first of his denials in this passage. And so it is Peter and Jesus in the olive press. Different responses, and we have things to learn from each of them. This is a more modern olive press, actually being used to squeeze olives in order to extract the oil. This is in Spain, and it's not new, but it's much newer than the one that we had depicted earlier. Gethsemane has very old olive trees. They do not date back to the first century, but they are very old. And the fact that it got the name olive press must mean that there was a press there somewhere on the grounds. And so that's the background on the title for this passage. Let's look at 18:1. Here we're going to have Jesus' arrival at Gethsemane. John is not going to give us a lot of details of his time there. He basically starts with the arrest, whereas Matthew, Mark, and Luke give us other events leading up to that. But in 18:1, having said these things, Jesus went out with his disciples across the Kedron Ravine, where a garden was, which he and his disciples entered. Now the arrows are showing the Kedron Ravine. You can see the Temple Mount and so forth. Off in the lower left corner, actually beyond the edge of the map, would be where Jesus has come from. He would have been in the upper room in chapters 13 and 14. At the end of chapter 14, they left the upper room and they started walking eastward. They probably tried to avoid encountering any officials, so I would say that they probably went a southern route, came to the Kidron, went north, crossed it, and went into Gethsemane. So John has skipped over a lot of the details. Matthew, Mark, and Luke go into more detail about events leading up to verse 2. Now, this we're looking within the Kidron Valley, and we're looking up onto the Mount of Olives, and the Garden of Gethsemane. You see where it's been situated. So it's very, very old olive trees there within that grove. In verse 2, now Judas, the one betraying him, also knew the place, because Jesus also often met there with his disciples. Within John's gospel, we see Jesus spending quite a bit of time in Jerusalem. When you look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, none of them detail Jesus making trips down to Jerusalem. Their purposes in Matthew, Mark, and Luke are different than John's. Much attention is given to his preparation of his disciples in the synoptics. But John's gospel is not focused upon the training that Jesus gave to his disciples. It is focused instead upon the message of life for unbelievers. John's gospel is the only book of the New Testament written to the unbeliever. The purpose statement in John 20, 30, and 31 says many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these, the eight signs, are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing this, have life in his name. The fact that John is writing to unbelievers seeking to persuade them of the life-giving message means that John has to arrange his book differently. It is important for John to specify that Jesus has been in Jerusalem. Now, let's see. Here we have another picture of an overhead of the route taken, and so on and so forth, and Garden of Gethsemane. Okay, here we are. Jesus visits to Jerusalem. Up at the top, you'll notice that some of these items are marked in with a green highlight. Pesach is the word for Passover. So in John 2, there's a Passover. Jesus was in Jerusalem. And then for the unnamed feast that I believe was Tabernacles or Sukkot, the Feast of Booths, Jesus was also in Jerusalem, John chapter 5. Jesus returned to Jerusalem in John 7 and stayed there through the first part of John 10. Then he went north and then came back to Jerusalem for Hanukkah at the end of John 10. He returned to Jerusalem in John chapter 12. So Jesus has made many visits to Jerusalem, and he would have taken his disciples with him. So when we're told that Judas knew the place because Jesus often went there, we note that there are several visits that John catalogs. There probably were some additional visits that are not mentioned by John. But besides that, whether the feast was Tabernacles or Pentecost or Passover, each of those feasts involved several days. So Jesus would have spent time in the Jerusalem area, and the Garden of Gethsemane was a place for him to get away from the religious officials and from the crowds and so forth. So it would have been a place that Judas was familiar with because Jesus often went there whenever he was down in Jerusalem. So John is giving us this detail so that it explains how it is that Judas knows where to go. The last that we saw of Judas was back in John 13, verse 30. They have had the Passover meal, and in the process of the meal, at one point Jesus gave to Judas the dipped bread, and then at that point John 13:30 says that Judas left. He would have gone straight to the religious officials with whom he had previously reached an agreement to betray Jesus. It would have taken a little bit of time for them to organize, because we're going to find that there's a large group that came out in order to arrest Jesus. The officials were worried that there might be armed resistance. So Judas has seen the clock ticking, and so probably he first went to the upper room, which is where he left, but then he would figure, well, the Garden of Gethsemane would be a likely place. So in all probability, Judas led them first to the upper room, and then after that led them over here to the Garden of Gethsemane. So that sets us up for verse 3. So Judas led a detachment of soldiers and some deputies from the chief priests and the Pharisees, and came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. The religious officials would have wanted to involve the Romans. After all, they were very concerned about the possibility of being blamed for putting Jesus to death, and they figured that that would upset their relationship with the people, and so they wanted to be able to blame it on the Romans. So they involved the Romans. That was out of convenience. We are told that later on in John that when Pilate suggested, well, maybe you ought to crucify him, they said, well, we don't have the right to crucify. We don't have the right to put anyone to death. You do. And so John tells us that as a result of this, as a result of them turning him over to the Romans, it meant that Jesus' prediction of the type of death he would die is actually accomplished. Back in John chapter 12, Jesus said that he would be lifted up. That is not what would happen under a Judean form of killing. They would use stoning. They would not lift a person up, but they would dedicate a monument to them, that is, a pile of rocks on top. So Judas is leading a detachment of soldiers. Not that he's in charge, but he's the one who knows where to go. There also were deputies from the chief priests and Pharisees. These would be the temple police. Then we have the chief priests and Pharisees. This is an indication that we have representatives of the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin, the official ruling body for Jewish people in Jerusalem, was comprised of both Sadducees, chief priests, and Pharisees. They came with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Now, the reason for lanterns and torches is that they would not know whether Jesus would try to escape, whether they would have to go searching for him. Now, this is at Passover, so it is a full moon. So it's not pitch dark outside. We do have a full moon at that time, but they've come prepared to go searching for Jesus. But they also have brought weapons, because Jesus has a large following, and there are many people that are in town, and if word had somehow leaked there might be quite a contingent of Jesus' followers. So they're coming prepared for major confrontation or for Jesus escaping. Let's say something a little bit more about the detachment. The word here would refer to a sizable portion of soldiers. It could be up to 600. They wouldn't have sent them all in one place, but probably there would be ones who went here and there in order to cut off possible routes of escape if it turned out that Jesus heard the large contingent coming, and here they come with torches and so on and so forth. So they would be prepared to cut off routes of escape. So it's probably not all of them coming up into the Garden of Gethsemane, but it would be probably one sent out here and there in order to cut off routes of escape. What is Jesus' response? Is it flight? Is it fight? It is neither. Verse 4. So Jesus, knowing everything that was coming upon him, went out and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" So he would have spoken to the commander, who would be the Roman commander of the troops. But when it says, knowing everything that was coming upon him, John chapters 13 through 17, the last discourse, shows Jesus preparing his disciples for the worst time in their life. Jesus will be arrested, he'll be tried, he'll be convicted and put to death. He'll be in the tomb for 3 days, and during all this time, the disciples are thinking their whole life has come crashing in. In that last discourse, Jesus said on several occasions, "I am predicting these things so that when they happen, you may believe." Believe what? Believe that I will be resurrected, just as I said. They were already believers in him for eternal life. That happened for the disciples that are mentioned in John chapter 1, way back in John chapter 1. And in fact, I would argue that they probably were, those disciples were Old Testament believers prior to the point that they met Jesus. The one exception, of course, is Judas. Back in John chapter 13, Jesus made it clear that Judas was not clean. Judas was not a believer, but the others he described as clean because they had believed. So, in that last discourse, Jesus has already detailed, he's given us information showing us that he knows what was going to happen to him. Jesus has predicted many times that he would be arrested, he would be put to death, and he would rise again on the third day. But as we look at the last discourse, Jesus predicted that Peter would deny him. He predicted that the one to whom he gave the sop at the Lord's table, that's the one who would betray him. And he predicted that he was going to die. He predicted that he would rise again. Everything there was already in place to show the disciples that, yes, indeed, Jesus did know everything that was coming upon him. But he didn't run away. Nor did he order his disciples to fight. In fact, later in this book, we're going to find Jesus being interrogated by Pilate. And Pilate asked a question, and Jesus indicated that no, his kingdom was not going to be sourced from planet Earth. And he added to that, that if his kingdom were sourced on planet Earth, that his disciples would have fought to prevent Jesus from being arrested and betrayed and arrested by the Judean officials, who were actually the ones that were making sure that all this happened. The Romans were there basically to provide security. So Jesus has shown that he knows everything, but he's not running away. Instead, he went out and met them. They're coming into the garden, and he steps forward, steps out from amongst his disciples. He takes leadership, and he says, "Whom do you seek?" So they answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." And Jesus' answer was, "I am." Now, it's interesting what happened when he said this. Let's skip up to verse 6. So when he told them, "I am," and you'll notice that the word "he" is in italics, is specifically saying, "I am," they went back and fell to the ground. And that's what this artist is depicting here. That seems to be a glimpse of Jesus' power. Jesus referred to that power in the Synoptic Gospels when he told Peter, at the time that Peter cut the ear off the high priest's slave, that "I could have called 12 legions of angels. What are you doing trying to pull out your sword? If I really needed protection, I had it available to me. But I wasn't seeking that protection." They fell to the ground. They were knocked over. And the rendering really should be understood as him saying, "I am." If you remember back from Exodus 3 and Exodus 6, this is God's covenant name. Now, Yahweh, "I am that I am." It's his covenant name. Now, it's important to understand that it's a name, whereas God is a title. A title is like a job description. And God is not a name, but it's a description. It's speaking about one who is eternal and has all the infinite attributes that God possesses. But Yahweh is his personal covenant name. Covenants that he entered into with Israel, the four unconditional covenants, all go back to this. And when we think about Exodus, it's very important to understand what Moses was told. He asked, "Well, who am I going to say sent me?" And that was where he was given the revelation at the seeing the burning bush, the bush that was not consumed but was burning. He was told to take off his sandals, and that because the ground that Moses was standing on was holy. And as he conversed with the Lord revealed his covenant name. And it is not that the patriarchs back in the book of Genesis did not know the name, but they did not understand the significance of the name. That is what was revealed to Moses. The significance of it was that when God made promises, when Yahweh made promises to Israel, there was nothing, not even the greatest power on planet Earth, Egypt, that would be able to stand in his way. God would fulfill his promises. God is one who has all the power, but he also is loyal to his covenant. Jesus uttered this. He said, "I am." And with that, all those that came to arrest him were suddenly on their backs on the ground. With that display of power, it becomes very interesting, the sequence of events after this. Notice verse 7. They ask him again, "Whom do you seek?" "Jesus the Nazarene," they said. So Jesus replied, "I told you that I am. So, if you seek me, let these," that is his disciples, "go." And that's precisely what happened. The disciples scattered. Interestingly, just as Jesus predicted. He had said in the last discourse that they would abandon him. They would leave him alone, but he was not going to be alone because the Father was with him. Now, I don't know that John ever abandoned him. It does not seem that that happened, because John was present at the cross and actually saw the spear thrust into Jesus. He was personal witness up close to where he was able to converse with the Lord at the time that Jesus entrusted his mother's care to John. But Jesus' statement was he was going to be abandoned, and the disciples, virtually all of them, did so. The Romans and the temple officials, one would have expected that they would want to arrest anyone who would be associated with this one that has been purported to be this huge troublemaker. But yet they allowed them to go. And it is particularly amazing because of what happened next. So Simon Peter, having a sword, and it would be of this type, it's not a long one, it's one that would be able to be hidden under his robes, concealed carry, he drew it, struck the high priest's servant, and severed his right ear. Now the servant's name was Malchus. Now, with Peter drawing blood, wouldn't one expect that there would be a sudden rush to pull out swords and deal with at least Peter, but probably deal with Jesus and everyone who's with him? But instead, the only blood that was drawn that night there in Gethsemane was of Malchus's ear. Jesus said, "Let these go." And that glimpse that was given of Jesus' power that knocked everyone on their backs is probably an indication of a lot of things that were going on that night in a supernatural way in order to verify exactly what it was that Jesus had predicted. He had predicted that not one of his disciples would perish. And as he spoke that, he was speaking in a couple of different senses. So, in verse 11, Jesus told Peter, "Sheathe your sword. Should I not drink the cup which the Father has given me?" The cup is a reference to the cross. And Jesus is saying, I'm going ahead with this. And the reason I'm going ahead with it is because this is what the Father wants. And Peter at various times has gotten confused on this issue. We would see that if we looked in Matthew 16 and so forth. But right here within John's Gospel, we have Jesus having made it very clear that he's going to need to die. He predicted that way back in John chapter 2. 3 years earlier. He said, "Destroy this sanctuary." And John tells us the sanctuary that he was speaking of was his body. "Destroy this sanctuary, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." He said that 3 years prior to this. Peter has gotten sideways. Peter is going to continue to be sideways. Jesus is handling the olive press well. Jesus is doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing. But Peter is not. Peter thinks that he knows better than Jesus. And he's pulling out his sword when he shouldn't be. And it won't be long. And he's going to show cowardice when he should not. Peter is not handling the olive press well, but Jesus is. That now brings us to Jesus being in the high priest's court. So he is now arrested, verse 12. So the detachment, its captain, and Judean deputies arrested Jesus and bound him. Notice this verse makes it very clear that the detachment and its captain are quite distinct from the Judean deputies that were under the authority of the Sanhedrin. This is very clear evidence that Romans were involved, besides the fact that a technical term is used for the detachment. But this is the point of Jesus' arrest. The disciples have scattered because they simply are not going to be allowed to be part of the arresting party. But they led him first to Annas. Now, it's going to be important. This is a likely location of Annas's house has been located. And there would be a courtyard, and that's where Peter was. And then we have the court. That is a courtroom, shall we say, in a reception hall where Jesus was. Why is it important that Jesus and Peter were close by? Well, in Luke, at the conclusion to the third denial by Peter, it is mentioned that when the cock crowed, Peter's eyes met Jesus' eyes. So they are in close proximity to one another. And you can imagine how that hit Peter like a ton of bricks, because Jesus had predicted it. Although Peter had said he was going to die that night for Jesus, that instead, Peter did exactly what Jesus had predicted. He denied Jesus 3 times. So, it's going to be important at various points for us to be aware of this household. Something that is probable here is that this would be Caiaphas's house, but there probably is an apartment that's attached, part of it, where Annas lived. Annas is going to be described as Caiaphas's father-in-law. So let's look at verse 13. And they first led him away to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who during that year was high priest. Annas was high priest. And if you look at the right-hand side of this, he was high priest from the year 6 AD up through 15. And the number that's at the far right, that's 10 years that he was high priest. He's going to have 5 sons and 1 son-in-law, all of whom became high priest. So we have point B under the name Eleazar. Eleazar, if you look on the right, he was high priest from 16 to 17, 2 years. He had a daughter. We do not know the daughter's name because Josephus has not recorded it for us. But she married Caiaphas, so that's son-in-law to Annas. He was high priest for 19 years, from the year 18 to the year 36. This is a pretty clear indication that Caiaphas got along well with the Romans. Only Annas and Caiaphas had long tenures, although in the year 15, the Romans deposed Annas. He could no longer officially have the title high priest. It became one of his sons or a son-in-law, or in one case, a grandson that became high priest. But Annas was always called high priest by his loyal followers, even though he did not possess the position. You know, it's like former presidents of the United States are often called Mr. President, even though they are no longer in office. So then we have Jonathan. He was high priest from 36 to 37. Theophilus from 37 to 41. Matthias from in the year 43. There were others that were brought in by the Romans in the years 44 to 61. Then in 62, Ananus. And then Theophilus's grandson. I mean, Theophilus's son, who would be Annas's grandson, was high priest from 65 to 66. So this is Annas's family tree. And so Caiaphas and Annas are power brokers in Jerusalem. They were wealthy. And a major reason for that is that anything that went on in the temple, all of the offerings and so forth, and the sale of animals and the exchanging of money, they had a cut in that. They were skimming. They had a lot of wealth because of the things that they were conducting on the side. The whole picture, the power structure of the high priesthood was that he was in charge not only of the temple, but of the high priest, that is, and of the priesthood, as well as the Sadducees. That sect then just was seeking to keep peace between within Israel. They did not want to have riots in Jerusalem because they knew that if there were riots, if they got out of control, then the Romans would have no more use for Annas and his family. So they didn't particularly like the Romans. The Romans didn't particularly like them, but they cooperated with each other because as long as Annas and his family cooperated with the Romans, they could have their fiefdom and they could have all their power and all of their money. The Romans were happy to have someone else dealing with the Judean population to prevent riots and so on and so forth. So they each found a reason to cooperate with the others. Now, the Pharisees didn't like all this that was going on with the Sadducees, did not like what was going on with the high priesthood and his whole family. And that, so there was a lot of internal turmoil. But when it came to Jesus, after John 11, with the raising of Lazarus, the Sadducees joined in with the Pharisees in overwhelmingly wanting Jesus to be put to death. That is why Jesus is brought to Annas. Annas is conducting a preliminary exam while Caiaphas is working with the rest of the high priests in order that they can pull together the witnesses, in order that they would be able to say that, well, in their kangaroo court, that yes, they had convicted Jesus of a capital crime. So Annas is here on a fact-finding mission to find out anything he can of use to Caiaphas, and that's the reason that there was this stopover to see Annas. Caiaphas was busy trying to get things arranged, and Annas was there seeing if he could find out any information and keeping Jesus occupied while Caiaphas was making his preparations. The two of them seem to reside in the same house, with Annas having an apartment in one part of the facility. Verse 14. Now Caiaphas was who had advised Judean leaders it was beneficial that one man perish in place of the people perishing. Let's turn back to John chapter 11 and we'll see how all of this transpired. Jesus has raised Lazarus. And as a result of raising Lazarus, we have many people who were present that came to believe. And we're told that in John 11:45. And many of the Judeans who had come to Mary, that is, they had come to comfort Mary and Martha regarding the death of their brother Lazarus, when they saw Jesus raise him, many believed in him. But there were some of the Judeans who had come to comfort Mary and Martha that went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council, that is a Sanhedrin, and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him. And then they're expecting that there are going to be riots. And as a result, they say, after everyone believes in him, the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So they're saying, we will have proved ourselves incapable of controlling the people, and the Romans will say, we don't have any use for you. And they'll wipe their hands of the Sadducees, and they will take charge of the nation. And so this is panic time. They're saying, Jesus is too successful. This raising of Lazarus, We've got to put him to death. We have to do something. Verse 49. And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, and by the way, it's not saying it was an annual office, but what it's saying is that monumental year, he was high priest. He said, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish." He's saying, in his thinking, well, if Jesus dies, then the Romans don't conquer us, and the populace survives, and so do we. But if Jesus stays alive, there will be riots, because people will believe in him, and those believers will riot, and as a result of that, the Romans are going to come in, and they're going to destroy everything and kill almost everybody, and so he's saying, our choice is clear. Jesus needs to die. But John tells us, verse 51, now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not only for that nation, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. In other words, diaspora Jews would be reunited because Jesus is making payment for sin and setting up all the preparation that the millennial kingdom can happen. Caiaphas is the one with that terrible advice. We are being reminded here that Caiaphas is an enemy of Jesus. So we cannot expect that there is going to be a legitimate set of trials being headed up by the mafia, Annas and Caiaphas. It's the La Cosa Nostra, it's the mafia that controlled the temple. Jesus is not going to get a fair trial. When we look at further passages, though, we will see that Jesus, in the Olive Press, conducted himself admirably. He did not cave in. He spoke the truth, and he did exactly what the Father wanted him to do. He did not cave in. He's the one with the most to lose. But unlike Peter, he does exactly what the Father wants. Now we're going to conclude by looking at Peter's first denial in the high priest's courtyard. We have to set something up here. So in verse 15, now Simon Peter and the other disciple were following Jesus. The other disciple is John the Apostle. Now that disciple was known to the high priest, so he entered the high priest's courtyard with Jesus. And you might say, well, how is it that any of Jesus' disciples could possibly have known the high priest? And if they came to know them, him during their time with Jesus, they would not, this person would not be welcomed into the household. But there is a lot of information on the wholesale fish trade in Israel. And there's something fascinating about archaeological digs in Jerusalem. One of the things that they find there in the times that Jews lived in Jerusalem, first century and other times, Archaeological digs in Jerusalem regularly encounter fish bones. But Jerusalem is not a place where you catch fish, and the Dead Sea is not a place where you catch fish. Fish can come from the Mediterranean Sea, and they come predominantly from the Sea of Galilee, here called the Lake Gennesaret on the map, which is one of its alternate names. And the varieties of fish that live in the Sea of Galilee are found in those archaeological digs of the types of fish bones. There was a thriving trade because you had to have people catch fish. Then they had to be either salted and dried or pickled. There were various things in lieu of not having refrigeration that were done in order to preserve the fish, and then they would be transported down to Jerusalem. A plausible case has been made that John and James, the sons of Zebedee, were engaged in the wholesale fish trade. And when one looks at the mother of the sons of Zebedee, something very interesting emerges, that she gives evidence of being someone who is a social climber. Very interesting thing as we look at Mark chapter 10. Matthew records that actually the one who made the initial request was the mother of the sons of Zebedee. And so if we look at Mark chapter 10, verse 35, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him saying, "Teacher, we want for you to do for us whatever we ask." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you? Grant that we may sit, one at your right hand and the other at your left in your glory." The question was actually posed by their mother, according to Matthew. They were the ones that wanted to know, but the mother was the one that asked them. I think that's a pretty bold question for someone to ask Jesus. That does not sound like the question of an impoverished woman. That sounds like the question of a social climber. We're told in Luke chapter 5 that when Jesus met up with the disciples that he called on the Sea of Galilee, that they, James and John, left their father, but as they did so, the servants continued their work. John comes from a family of means. And when we encounter the mother of the sons of Zebedee, where is it that we encounter? It's somewhere in the vicinity of Jericho or Jerusalem. When one looks at where Jesus was at the time of Matthew chapter 10. And so this is very important that she really seems to be associated with Jerusalem. It was either in Jericho or even more likely in Jerusalem that the Mark 10 passage occurs. She's associated with Jerusalem. The family has money, And the question that she asks is something that a social climber, not an impoverished woman, is likely to ask. Knowing that the fish trade was a source of great wealth, there's been a lot that's been written. There's been a lot of archaeological work that's been done on the wholesale fish trade. There are a lot of things that have surfaced, and there's a fair amount of literature on this. That sets up a very plausible basis for John being known to the high priest, because as a child, his family would have run in the circles of the wealthy and powerful in Jerusalem. So John doesn't have any problem entering through the gate. The slave girl that is the gatekeeper recognizes him and allows him to enter. But Peter, that's a different story. But Peter was standing outside by the gate. So the other disciple, John, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the girl keeping the door and brought Peter inside. Now, when we get this scenario that the gatekeeper would recognize John's face, has no problem letting him in, but is also willing to let Peter in because John makes a specific request that Peter be allowed in, that's going to affect how we understand the next verse. So the servant girl keeping the door said to Peter, "You are not one of this man's disciples also, are you?" This is giving indication that she knew that John was a disciple of Jesus, but that didn't preclude him from being allowed in. He was not a troublemaker. And it is on the basis of the connection with John that she knows as a disciple what does Peter say? "I am not." And can you imagine what John is thinking? I'm saying, Jesus predicted that you were going to do this. Now, Peter, you tend to be bold and you stick your foot in your mouth in boldness, but here you're sticking your foot in your mouth as you're chickening out. John is identified as an apostle, as a disciple of Jesus. Notice that word also. Peter has denied being it, even though John has been admitted despite being a disciple. Peter really is not standing on firm ground here. From the standpoint of his denial of Christ, obviously he's not on firm ground. But it doesn't make sense that he would say, "Oh, I better deny him," despite the fact that John is being admitted in here, has been admitted, despite them knowing that he's a disciple of Jesus. There's an interesting clue that we're going to get in verse 18 as well. The charcoal fire. There would have been torches to light the area, but Peter is wanting to warm himself. And we're told that he was standing close to the charcoal fire because it was cold that morning. So in verse 18, "Now servants and deputies stood around, having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold, and were warming themselves. Now Peter was with them, standing and warming himself. If he's standing close enough to a charcoal fire to feel its heat, his face is being illuminated by the charcoal fire, as well as by the lanterns that would be around the courtyard. It's not going to be hard for people to make out his face. And the fact that he was the one that pulled out a sword at Gethsemane would make it so that his face, of all the disciples' faces, would register in the minds of the servants and deputies. We're later going to find that a relative of Malchus was also present in Gethsemane. Peter's going to deny to him that he's one of Jesus' disciples. Servants saw what had happened. Deputies saw what had happened. And Peter imagines that he is going to be anonymous if he just denies Jesus. Oh my. What we see in this passage is a stark contrast between what Jesus does in the Olive Press. He boldly goes out to those who are arresting him and says, "Whom do you seek?" They said, "Jesus the Nazarene." On two occasions he said, "I am." And the first time, all the arresting people were knocked over. Jesus said, "Let these men go," despite the fact that Peter then pulls out a sword and strikes the high priest's servant. All of Jesus' disciples are allowed to go. Jesus has done exactly what the Father wanted him to do, despite being in the olive press. But Peter fails twice. He pulls out the sword at a time that Jesus was supposed to allow himself to be arrested. Peter is complicating things, and it requires a supernatural intervention, I am sure, to prevent all the disciples from having been killed on the spot. And they were allowed to leave. Then, after John is able to get Peter inside, servant girl recognizes, okay, you're with John. John's a disciple. You must be one too. And he denies it. And there he is in the midst of people who would be likely to be able to identify him. And he imagines that by denying that he is associated with Jesus, that he's going to have security. But where is his security, really? Jesus had predicted that none of his disciples would perish on this occasion. And none of them would ever lose eternal life. Jesus does admirably in the olive press. Peter not so much. We, like Peter, so often fail, but Jesus remains faithful. Questions?
John, I have a question here. It's
yes.
It's kind of like two questions. First of all, if the high priest has authority over the Roman dispatching, that's why we went with Judas?
The high priest, they have apparently made previous contact with Pilate, indicating that they were going to arrest him, that he was a troublemaker. As they said back in, if we were to look at Luke's account, well, let's actually go back there, because Luke shows us that there had been prior arrangements, and that so all of that is understood here. It's part of the background on it. Because Luke is actually pointing that there's a prior contact. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he heard that Jesus is associated with Galilee. You know, then all of a sudden he's wanting to pass him off to Herod in order for Herod to examine him and so on and so forth. I would say that everything's pointing toward there had been prior contacts, and they had told him, you know, this man's claiming to be king of the Judeans and all these types of things. Pilate had no concept that Jesus would have lived in Galilee. And so the, I would say that there were prior contacts. And so as a result of those prior contacts, they're able to say, okay, now is the time to arrest him. They knew this. They probably would have started making the contacts once Judas had agreed to betray Jesus. That at that point, you know, they've got a plan of action. They know that they should be able to arrest Jesus in a way that's not going to call public attention. That Judas knows where Jesus goes at night and so on and so forth. So I think that's probably indicating the prior contacts and so forth.
John, because of what we read in John 11, when they said we got to get rid of this guy, and Jesus leaves at that time, they probably started the contact way back then, wouldn't you think?
That
people are looking for him.
That actually makes good sense, because we do have, I mean, the bounty was placed, and we do have the people looking and saying, you know, surely he's not going to come to the feast and so forth. Yeah, you're right.
Okay, the second question, John. Why is only John writes and said when Jesus came out and say, I am he, and all will fall down, but the others are not gospels, doesn't mention any of this?
Each writer has been selective, and I don't know why they didn't say that. I mean,
the reason I'm asking this, John, because some of the critics say this only John making Jesus look more powerful, but the other Gospels writers making him more like a critic going to the cross. And he used this one as only John is the one writing about this incident, making looks like he's a hero here. He said, I'm here, and everybody followed him down.
Yeah, no, I understand the criticism, but it's answering why the other writers didn't include it is trying to get into their mind. I don't know why they didn't include it. I mean, it's like I have a question as to why is it that John didn't mention that the statement. I lost my train of thought on that, but I don't know how to answer that one because each of the writers had their own reasons for the way that they wrote, and they did so under inspiration. I don't know of a way to answer that.
Hey, John, in your chart that you had up there, when you went through the timeline on this, I really like the green marks up there. This is when Jesus, no, before that, his travels into Jerusalem.
Oh, okay, sure. Okay,
here right we go. There. Yep. I really like this idea of this is when Jesus was in those, went to the festivals. But I was wondering, where in Luke 6 does it say that he was at the second Passover?
I didn't say that he went to Jerusalem, but what we have is it gives an indication that there was that Passover. Luke 6:1 in the majority text says that the particular day was the second first Sabbath. So that puts Luke chapter 6 time-wise in the vicinity of Passover.
Can you explain the second first Sabbath? How does that work?
Okay, under the Jewish calendric system, they divided the year into 7 week of periods, and so there would be 7 week periods. That comes out to 49 weeks. Then there would be the three pilgrim feasts that were outside of that timetable. So you have Passover, then 7 weeks later, you have the Feast of Pentecost, and then subsequently you have the Feast of Tabernacles, and there's essentially a 7 week interval in between. So work has been done by, I believe, Morgan Stern on the calendric system in Hookah. And so what he has demonstrated is that their calendric system, they would say, you have the seven Sabbaths within the first 7 week period. Then you have the seven Sabbaths within the second 7 week period, seven Sabbaths within the third, and so forth. So when it says the second first, it's the second Sabbath of the first time period, because the new year started with Passover, or actually started 2 weeks prior to Passover.
So that wouldn't be the Pentecost festival? That would be the...
Well, it's within the first... under the ideal, barley harvest is at Passover.
Okay.
Their calendar moved around a bit because they were on a lunar calendar.
And so the heads of grain in Luke 6 are barley grains?
That's probable, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
John, I had a question. It's a little off topic, you got into the history of the family history of Caiaphas and the high priests. You went to the year 66. What event happened in 70 to cause Jerusalem to be destroyed? My history is not very good.
Well, there was a revolt by the Judeans. And so the fact that there was revolt meant that the Romans decided that, well, they were not going to allow Judea to come out from under Roman rule, so that's when they sent in the 10th Legion in order to quell the rebellion.
Thank you.